I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Michael Benson, author of the new nonfiction book, Gangsters vs. Nazis. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. While we typically begin Too Jewish on a light note, I promise we will have some fun this morning. This weekend is a good time to reflect on an important and more serious question. How do we go about remembering those we have lost who have honored our society by their actions? For the ways in which we remember say a lot about us as people and as a country. This is Memorial Day weekend. Once a solemn and serious time for commemorating our war dead. Now a good excuse to begin the summer and head off for vacation. It's true that the actual observance of Memorial Day has declined to the point that it seems to represent not much more than a good weekend to start holding barbecues and pool parties, shopping for bargains at stores and big box retailers, or heading off to the cool weather. But that's actually a bit of a shame. For remembering our honored dead is a kind of moral responsibility, and it has great resonance in Jewish tradition. Our American Memorial Day began in New York State just a year after the end of the Civil War, 1866. Communities began to observe a Decoration Day to honor the dead of that great conflict. Within a couple of years, the observance had become a national and near universal commemoration, a sign of the broad sense of loss that the horrible American Civil War had created. While the concept of a specific Memorial Day may date from the 1860s, the idea of having a specific time to remember and honor the dead is an idea that is particularly normative for Judaism and has been for many, many hundreds of years. Four times a year, we Jews observe a special service called Yizkor, Remembrance. Yizkor, that allows all of us who have lost loved ones to gather together and remember their lives and meaning. This coming week, that is Sunday, next Sunday, the holiday of Shavuot includes Yizkor memorial prayers. In addition, there are two other Jewish versions of Memorial Day that are more contemporary ways of remembering. Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, both fall in the late spring. In fact, you could say that we Jews have a certain affinity for somber observances of Memorial Days, perhaps because we have so often lost people early, under tragic and terrible circumstances. And so, in the early heat of a Sonoran desert summer in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, it seems very Jewish to take a few moments to remember those, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln's timeless phrase from the best and shortest memorial speech ever, who gave their lives that our own nation might live. To play a sin this morning on Too Jewish, on that somber but important theme, here's Israeli-Moroccan singing star Gad Elbaz. It's his version of the 23rd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd."
ינחני במגני צדק למען שמו, גם כי אלך בגיא צל מוות, לא ירא רע כי אתה עמדי, שבתך ומשענתך הם מה ינחמוני.
was Gad Elbaz singing the 23rd Psalm. Since this is Memorial Day weekend, it also marks the official beginning of summer in many parts of the country, when we begin to relax and have some fun and, you know, read some summer books. The temperatures are warm, the sky is clear, things slow down. With that in mind, we have a summer book for you. Our guest this morning, Michael Benson, has researched and told a remarkable true story about Jewish gangsters and boxers who opposed American Nazis in the build-up to World War II. It's quite the tale. Find out all about it when we return here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Michael Benson has written, only about 60 books, including renowned books about the mafia in America. His new book is called Gangsters Versus Nazis, How Jewish Mobsters Battled Nazis in Wartime America. And it's a great read and a fascinating story, and not one that's been told much. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Rabbi.
It's a pleasure. So people think that Germany and Nazi Germany was all in Germany, but there was the German Bund in America was really a big thing in the 1930s. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, yeah, there was about 100,000 members of the German-American Bund during the Depression, and they were scapegoating Jewish Americans, saying that the Jews were responsible for the Depression. They had all of the money, and they needed to be wiped out. And all of this was, you know, quite a shock to the rag man in Newark, New Jersey, whose horse just dropped dead in the middle of the street. He didn't have all the money. So something needed to be done about these guys. There was also no hate speech laws back then.
Right.
So as long as they didn't say anything obscene or shout fire in a crowded room, they were within their First Amendment rights to say whatever they wanted about Jewish Americans.
So the German-American Bund, by the way, it's important to make a distinction because there were other Bunds, including Jewish Bunds. You know, it just meant the group, really. But these guys were kind of proto-Nazis, right? Or Nazi wannabes. And they would do the Nazi salute in their meetings and talk about all the same things.
They were having parades like the Thanksgiving Day parade in Manhattan, only with goose-stepping and Sieg Heiling.
So clearly something had to be done about it. I think you note in your book at one point, there's a quotation, New York Jews might have been the toughest Jews in the world, except for the ones in New Jersey and Newark. Tell us a little bit about how the Jewish response evolved to this.
Well, the catalyst was a fellow by the name of Judge Nathan Perlman, who was himself a Jewish immigrant. And he had become a U.S. congressman. He was one of the men who voted to repeal Prohibition, which he never let his bartender forget. and one day he sees something that shocks him. He's downtown Manhattan, and a ceremony to swear in new American citizens has to move inside on a beautiful sunny day because the German-American Bund is taking over Bowling Green Park, and they're chanting, you know, hateful things about the Jews. So he goes to a bar and light bulb goes on over his head, and he calls the greatest Jewish gangster of all times, the GOAT, Meyer Lansky.
Meyer Lansky, right. We don't think about Jews as gangsters, but of course there were famous Jewish gangsters, Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohen, whom you quote also in the book, and a bunch of other guys, Lepke Buchalter, you may not know so much about.
Plus, the Italian mobsters got all the press, but largely because Lansky was Lucky Luciano's right-hand man, there was a piece of the pie for Jewish men who wanted to go into the racket.
And so this judge calls Meyer Lansky, and what does he say?
Well, he says, "Yeah, do you have some guys who might be able to hurt some Nazis for me to show them that Jews are tough and that and that a Nazi in America can get hurt. And Lansky says, all due respect, Judge, but we can do better than hurt them. I mean, we're called Murder, Inc. for a reason.
Right.
And Judge Perlman says, no. If you start killing Nazis, we're going to lose the moral high ground, and it's going to get worse. So hurt them, don't kill them. And Lansky memorably later says, we didn't kill him, we just marinated.
It's a wild story, and one that I don't think has been told adequately. We will talk much more with Michael Benson. His book is Gangsters versus Nazis, How Jewish Mobsters Battled Nazis in Wartime America. When we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer, established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Wonderful progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, for more information. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Shavuot is coming up Saturday night at Beit Simcha. Join us as we explore what is holiness at our Tikkun Leil Shavuot festival service and semi all-night study session featuring a cheesecake bake-off, lots of delicious treats and drinks, and great Jewish learning. This Saturday night, June 4th, 7:30 p.m. at Beit Simcha, free for everyone. Call 520-276-5675 or just come. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. You can come also to our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. Our services with full music are in-person and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson, or by going to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful, really fantastic religious school is available in blended format, too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend Shavuot or Shabbat services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught in person and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing Jewish community and congregation in Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Post a rating and review 2Jewish wherever you're listening to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the Jewish community of Egypt, but really, as you noted, throughout history, it's been different Jewish communities. The first one we spoke about, I mean, besides the one of the era of the Exodus and Pesach, was the Elephantine Island community in the middle of, well, very far south in the Nile, not too far from Abu Simbel, actually, as I recall, way south. Really interesting story. That disappeared, was destroyed sometime in the Persian period. And of course, by that time, the temple has been rebuilt in Jerusalem and the center of Jewish life shifts back to Israel. The next great Egyptian Jewish community is in a Greek city, and it's Alexandria. Tell us about that.
Right. So Alexandria was, not surprisingly, founded by Alexander the Great.
Amazing how he did that.
And was the capital of that portion of the Greek Empire. Was a big port city in the Mediterranean.
About the most cosmopolitan city in the world,
right.
Probably at that time.
And even when Alexander the Great first built it, there were already a lot of Jews living there. Because in those early centuries before the Common Era, pretty much every port city in the Mediterranean had a Jewish population. And by the apogee of the Roman Empire, that was definitely true. And 10% of the population of the Roman Empire was Jewish, and they were almost all in these port cities all over the Mediterranean, Alexandria being chief among them. And the Jews of Alexandria began to encounter a certain degree of anti-Semitism, actually more from the Greeks than from the Egyptians. And they decided that they could diminish anti-Semitism by explaining themselves better. So they commissioned the first ever translation of the Hebrew Bible, which in English is called the Septuagint, which includes 70 books, some of which are not in the Jewish Bible today, but were then. And it's interesting to see which books got cast aside eventually. But this book was finished in the second century before the Common Era. Obviously, didn't defang anti-Semitism completely, but there's always been this theory that, well, if you know more about us, if you understand us better, you'll hate us less. I'm not sure that theory has ever actually worked, but this was a very expensive attempt to make that happen. And it's interesting that this Septuagint that most American Jews have never looked at or read or even heard of became the basis for what Christians call the Old Testament in a lot of the old Eastern churches, like the Coptic Church, the Armenian Church, the Georgian Church, the Balkan churches, all the like Bulgarian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
It's the Alexandrian Greek translation, the Septuagint, but also it becomes the source for the Latin translation used in the West, the Vulgate. Most of that was a translation of the Septuagint in the Old Testament. They didn't work from the Hebrew, they worked from the Greek.
Okay, and that was much later.
Yeah, yeah.
That was St. Jerome, I believe.
Yeah, correct.
So this huge Jewish community in Alexandria had its ups and downs over the centuries, as did Alexandria itself. I mean, when it was a Greek capital, it was a major place. Then it became like a dusty provincial town in Egypt, but it was always an important port. It's where the Nile enters the Mediterranean, basically. And there was the great Library of Alexandria. There were some famous wonders of the ancient world based there. And Jews throughout the ages, but especially after Jews started leaving the Iberian Peninsula, which began that sort of mini exodus long before 1492, it began in the 11th century. A lot of those Jews settled in Alexandria, and in the 1300s, they built a huge synagogue called Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the Prophet. That synagogue burned down in the 18th century, was rebuilt in the 19th century, and then after most Alexandrian Jews left for Israel, it fell into disrepair. And just very recently, like January 2020, right before the pandemic,
wow,
it was rededicated in a huge ceremony that brought back a lot of Alexandrian Jews who'd been married there or bar mitzvahed there or whatever, who were living in either Egypt or Italy or France or Canada, wherever they were living.
United States. Also,
they came back. And my buddy, who happened to be the American ambassador to Egypt at the time, attended this ceremony and said there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Yeah, extraordinary. Amazing Jewish community, Alexandria. A lot of great books written about it, even going all the way up to Ottoman times and almost contemporary times. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As Sara, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah are playing Mahjong one day, Sara suddenly says, "I have a confession, friends. We've known each other for many years. I feel I can tell you my secret. I'm a kleptomaniac. But don't worry. I've never stolen from any of you. I never will. You're my friends." Rivka says, "Okay, since we're having some confessions here, I'd like to admit I'm a nymphomaniac. But there's no need to worry. I've never tried to sleep with any of your husbands. I never will. You're my friends." "Well then," says Rachel, "I'd like to admit the reason I never married is I'm a lesbian, but there's no need to worry. I don't make any overtures to you. You're my friends. I wouldn't do that." The fourth woman, Leah, stands up and says, "I too have a confession. I'm a yenta. I love to gossip, and boy, do I have phone calls to make." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and make some phone calls. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, given its English name by the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of the Torah portion. The Hebrew name for the portion and this book is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. While the name comes from the first words of the book, it has greater resonance and meaning than simply its lexicographical location. It also speaks of place in a different and powerful way. You know, every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems we have to head out into the desert. That was true for Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses. And after the Exodus, it's true as well for the whole people of Israel, who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar, seeking God and revelation. Why must we head out into nothingness to find truth? Perhaps it's simply because our own lives are so filled with complication and complexity, which seems critical during our daily grind, but most of those things turn out to be unimportant. Until we leave behind the conveniences of home, until we divest ourselves of comforts and conceits, we are unable to really understand what matters. Faith can bloom freely in the desert, for there is nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it really is and coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator and maker of covenant. You too can find God in the wilderness. And that is just as true in the Sonoran Desert today as it was in the Sinai Desert for our ancestors. We simply need to look for God away from all the complications of our daily lives. The poet asks, "Must we enter the desert to hear your voice?" To which we Jews of the desert can answer, "Yes." When we return on Too Jewish this morning, our guest, Michael Benson, tells us just how gangsters and boxers fought American Nazis and Nazis in Europe, sometimes successfully in the lead-up to World War II. Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Fascinating, complex story today involves a huge historical archive of Jewish books and manuscripts, the Russian state, the U.S. government, Vladimir Putin, money, hidden assets, international law, Chabad, and, well, that's just for starters. When the U.S. government recently announced it would seek to seize the assets of VEB, Russia's main development bank, a lawyer for the Chabad Hasidic movement was thrilled. For years, Chabad has sought to recover a collection of sacred texts and documents taken from Chabad after the Russian Revolution around 1920, and other documents that during the Holocaust also ended up in the hands of the Kremlin. For years, the U.S. government stringently opposed Chabad's efforts to seize Russian assets as a bargaining chip in their quest. Now the United States is going after the very same funds, establishing a legal connection between VEB's assets and the Russian government. The federal government determined that VEB is a piggy bank for the Kremlin, essentially a tool of the Russian state, said Stephen Lieberman, the attorney representing Chabad pro bono in all of this. In hunting for Russian assets to seize amid an effort to sanction Russia for invading Ukraine, the White House, to some degree, is following Chabad's lead. The saga began in 2004 when Chabad Lubavitch, the Brooklyn-based Hasidic movement, filed a lawsuit in U.S. federal court demanding Russia return the Chabad texts. The court ruled in Chabad's favor, and after Russia failed to comply, of course, imposed a fine of $50,000 a day on the country. At this point, Russia owes Chabad more than $165 million, or approximately one-fourth the cost of Putin's yacht. Subsequent U.S. court orders have authorized Chabad to claim certain Russian assets in the amount of the fine. But claiming those assets requires finding them, because much of Russian wealth is tied up in ostensibly private companies, not the official Russian state. That's tricky. It requires a process of subpoena writing that attorney Nicholas O'Donnell, who specializes in lawsuits against foreign governments over property, like Nazi-looted art, compares to a game of whack-a-mole. It's hard, especially in this case, because the foreign sovereign Russia is acting in bad faith. He said they hide assets to avoid paying the money they owe. Chabad says it would prefer ownership of the collection of texts to seeing the fines continue to accrue. Known as the Schneerson Library and Archive, a historic collection of 12,000 books and 50,000 documents named for Rabbi Joseph Schneerson, the Rebbe who led the movement until his death in 1950 when he was succeeded by, you know, the guy whose picture you see everywhere at Chabad. Anyway, this library and trove of documents is considered to be of great sentimental value. It was amassed over 200 years and then stolen by the Russian government, bent on persecuting Chabad and Jews in general. Part of the collection is made up of a library that fell to Soviet authorities when Chabad fled to Poland in the early 1920s. The other part is an archive Chabad left behind when escaping the Nazis and relocating to the U.S. Our hope is that if we can seize those assets, it will put enough pressure on Putin and his minions that they will finally decide to return this library of holy books, which means so much to Jews throughout the world, but which means nothing at all to the Russian government, said the lawyer Lieberman. Years before Russia invaded Ukraine and the Biden administration decided to capture Russian wealth held in the U.S., Chabad's lawyers were busy tracking down that wealth. They issued subpoenas to numerous financial institutions and companies seeking relevant information. By late 2021, two entities emerged as Chabad's primary targets: Russia's main development bank, VEB, and Tenex, a subsidiary of a Russian state-run company called Rosatom that sells uranium to nuclear power plants in the U.S. The United States announced sanctions on VEB on February 22nd in the lead-up to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, freezing the bank's U.S. assets. its determination that VEV's effectively state wealth has given the lawyer Lieberman confidence that Chabad can eventually convince the U.S. Treasury Department to turn over VEB assets to Chabad. Treasury, from time to time, grants licenses where they essentially give third parties the right to assets they've seized, he said. They've done that in certain terrorism cases. Not everyone is sure things will play out so favorably for Chabad. O'Donnell, the expert attorney who has been following the case but not working on it, says it's likely the United States government would resist claims on the seized assets. I'm not sure the U.S. government wants to create a situation where they seize a whole bunch of money and then a whole bunch of other people who claim they've been wronged by Russia, which is a very, very long list, say they should be getting some or all the money, he said. If VEB's U.S. assets are all tied up in sanctions, the Russian uranium entity 10X is still entirely unrestricted. That's because when the Biden administration imposed sanctions on Russia's energy industry on March 8th, it exempted nuclear power, allowing for the continued importation of Russian uranium. If we're allowed to seize the assets of 10X, Chabad will be the only religious organization in the world with its own nuclear power supply, said Lieberman, half-jokingly. Ironically, the U.S. government has long opposed Chabad's legal efforts against Russia, arguing the group's attempts to seize Russian assets will undermine diplomatic aims. In 2016, for example, the U.S. Department of Justice argued in a court filing that seizing assets could cause significant harm to the foreign policy interests of the United States. O'Donnell says the policy of the U.S. is to oppose civil claims against foreign governments, you know, like even Russia. The United States will almost always take the side of a foreign sovereign, no matter how regressive or repressive, he said. They do it for Saudi Arabia. They will do it for Iran. It's actually sort of shocking. The Chabad lawyer Lieberman declined to answer questions about whether Chabad has been in touch with the U.S. government about the issue, but he noted that there have been no court filings opposing its motions targeting VEB and 10X. The State Department has now come over to our side, Lieberman said, citing the government's publicly stated position on Russia. It's very clear that the U.S. government's interest is 100% in applying sanctions and seizures to assets of the Russian Federation. Finally, after 20 years, we're getting full support from the U.S. government. The Russian government says it considers the Jewish texts a treasure of the Russian people. Huh, they never talked about Jews as Russian people, but okay. Some of the collection is held by the Russian State Library and the Russian State Military Archive. Russian President Vladimir Putin tried to put the dispute to rest back in 2013, 9 years ago. He transferred some of the collection to Moscow's newly established Jewish Museum and Tolerance Center. Affiliated with Chabad and headed by Russian Chief Rabbi Beryl Lazar, a Chabad rabbi. Lazar's spokesperson, a Chabad rabbi named Goren, spoke about the dispute at the time. Putin's suggestion came as a surprise to us and not a very pleasant one, Goren said. We very much wanted to stay out of this, but when the president of Russia makes a suggestion, it is usually accepted. Ultimately, Putin's move did nothing to diminish the resolve of Chabad's Brooklyn headquarters, which kept pursuing the matter in court, meaning Chabad is in effect suing to claim property that's on display at a museum the movement itself runs in Russia. Ownership is what's at stake, says Lieberman. The books are under the control of the Russian government. If Chabad wanted to come and take them back to 770 Eastern Parkway, the headquarters, the answer is no. If Chabad's ability to operate in countries at odds with one another at the same time was difficult before, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has made things even trickier. Court rulings enabling Chabad to proceed are expected in the next few months. A wild and weird story indeed. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona. Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Michael Benson has written an incredible array of about 60 books, including nonfiction crime titles, Betrayal in Blood, Killer Twins, Mommy Deadliest, as well as with Frank DiMatteo, the American Mafia History books, Carmine the Snake, Mafia Hitman, Lord High Executioner. His new book is called Gangsters versus Nazis, and it traces the work of Jewish mobsters and boxers, actually, who fought American Nazis in the 1930s in the buildup to World War II. Tell us about some of the boxers that got involved and how they got involved.
Well, it's a slim line between gangsters and boxers to begin with in 1938. Because boxing is run by the mob. And it was very common for boxers, once they retired, if they still had their marbles, to
become enforcers, right? Bouncers, yeah.
And eventually become gangsters themselves. So, yeah, not so much in Manhattan, but in Newark in particular, and also in Chicago. The recruiting of tough Jews to battle the Nazis took place in boxing gyms. Now, Al Capone had his headquarters right next to Davy Miller's boxing gym in Kedzie Avenue in Chicago. And the guys were gophers and running for the gangsters, and the boxers were training to fight on Friday night, were blended together. You know, inseparable in some cases.
I mean, you mentioned like Barney Ross. I mean, some famous guys who were champions ended up as part of this effort to break up the Bund rallies, attack some of these guys on the streets, the brown shirts, the people that were attacking Jews.
Right. Well, and as an interviewer in England said just a few weeks ago, who doesn't want to punch a Nazi in the nose? So finding volunteers was pretty easy. And once the riot started in Newark, the entire Jewish neighborhood would show up, you know, have popcorn and sit and watch. Sometimes some guys would roll up their sleeves and hope they got a shot at one of the Nazis. And it was a very bad for Nazi morale. They had been brazen up until the time of the Yorkville riot. They just assumed that they were going to be able to say whatever they wanted about Jewish Americans, and there was never going to be any blowback. And all of a sudden, you know, they're getting punched in the face, their nose is where their cheekbone should be, they're heading for the emergency room, and they're going, what is all this?
Tell us about the Yorkville riots a little bit.
Yeah, this is the Murder, Inc. guys. Meyer Lansky himself comes. Now, these guys, they were part of what was called a set, and they were a independent fraternal order, not a member of any of the five
families in New York. Yeah.
And what they did is they carried out hits of murders.
Contract hits, right?
Yeah, contract hits that were pre-approved by the commission, which was made up of the bosses of the families. And sometimes they would send Jewish killers to kill the Italians who weren't doing the right thing and vice versa. So the police were thoroughly confused. They thought maybe the Jews and the Italians were having a war against one another. which was far from the case. So, but these guys were really good with guns in their hands, and some of them had been former collectors for little loan sharks.
Right.
But not all of them were really good at with their hands. So as a team building exercise more than anything else, Lansky takes the guys to Gleason's gym, which at that time was in the Bronx, and gives them a few lessons on how to throw combinations. And then the next time the German-American blend, the brown shirts, are having a rally at the Yorkville Casino on 86th Street in Manhattan, guys wait outside, and as disguises, they put on American Legion hats. This is a technique used by Albert Anastasia. He would, if he had to do kind of a high-profile hit, he would have his hitmen wear hats that said Made in Chicago. He says, now lose the hats on the way out. So they would shoot the guy, and on their way out, they'd lose the hat. Sure enough, 2 days later, it would be in the New York Press. Police think that the killers from Chicago were imported for the hit. And meanwhile, these guys are sitting in Midnight Rose's back room in Brownsville, Brooklyn, you know, playing cards. So it was a technique that they used. They put on American Legion hats, went in, did a really good job of busting up the Nazi rally. Everybody ran. Seven Nazis end up going to the emergency room. The worst was a broken leg, because Lansky admits they tossed one guy out the second story window, which is playing fast and loose with the no killing rule, but they got away with it. And on their way out, they threw their American Legion hats down and disappeared into the Manhattan night. And sure enough, the papers say, well, we suspect American Legion guys were behind us. And the American Legion guys, a lot of whom had fought in World War I, weren't too upset about
it. No, they didn't mind being associated with it.
They didn't like the idea of Germans getting aggressive again. You know, we took care of that in 1918. Do we have to do it again?
Right.
And of course,
right.
The answer was yes.
You mentioned the journalists. One of them, Herb Brin, is a guy I knew in Los Angeles.
And
his son, Dan Brin, they founded a Jewish newspaper there, The Heritage. I used to write for them years ago.
Dan was a source of mine.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Well, I mean, I didn't know this story about Herb. I didn't know his background. Tell us a little bit about how the kind of role those journalists played in all this.
Well, Herb had something else going for him other than the ability to write, and that was he could pass for Gentile. And he was troubled by the anti-Semites he worked with, and they would say things like, oh, well, you know, we don't mind you, because, you know, you're obviously a white man, not Jewish. And the distinction was clear in Germans' minds at that time, as Whoopi Goldberg recently learned. He is approached by B'nai B'rith and the Anti-Defamation, and they get him to infiltrate the Bund so that after the meetings go underground, because they're afraid of getting raided by tough guys, the gangsters know exactly where and when the meetings are going to be. And no matter how secret they try to keep it, it gets busted up, and they never figure out who the mole is. And so Herb gets a firsthand view of a lot of the action. And he was a perfect guy for the job, because he already knew a lot of the guys at Davy Miller's boxing club, which was only a block or two away from his dad's hardware store. And he admitted that as a kid, he spent some hours in there. You know, there was also a pool hall restaurant and a boxing club. So the one-stop Friday night date. Herb knew these guys, and he was the spy. He was the mole. And he would go to Sparky Rubenstein at the boxing club and say, you know, it's going to be at this address at this time. Be there, be square. And the gangsters, the guys who were running for errands for Al Capone, and all the boxers in the gym would go over there and
crash the party, as it were.
Yeah, for crashing the party in the worst possible way.
Yeah. At one point, LaGuardia, who's mayor of New York, outlaws the goose stepping and the brown shirts and the Nazi armbands. So they just cross the river and they go to Newark.
Well, yeah. And in Newark, it's really the largest opposition. Over there, the guy running the mob in Newark was a guy named Longies Willman.
Yeah.
Who was one of the five biggest bootleggers during Prohibition. He was a zillionaire. He dated Jean Harlow, the movie star at the time. And Judge Perlman calls him and says, can you put together an army for me? And Zwillman takes it seriously. And there's he forms a group called the Minutemen, named after the American Revolution guys. Because if there's Nazi activity, we could be there in a minute. And upwards of 1,000 guys participate in this war against the Nazis. So some of these battles get really huge.
Huge, right.
So Zwillman doesn't really want to get his hands dirty. So he puts in charge of the Minutemen a fellow by the name of Nat Arnim, who's one of the guys I discussed earlier, started out as a boxer and became a gangster. And interestingly, after Pearl Harbor, Nat Arnim enlists. He tours Europe the hard way from Normandy to Berlin on foot. And it says that twice during his march towards Berlin, he sees German POWs being marched in the opposite direction, who he recognizes and who recognize him from street fights they'd had in Newark, New Jersey. First Americans to fight Nazis had names like Tick-Tock Tannenbaum, Greasy Thumb Guzik, Bugsy Goldstein, and Pittsburgh Phil, who'd never been to Pittsburgh, and his name wasn't Phil.
This was a national thing, right? Because you talk about Chicago, you talk about Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then it gets to the West Coast. Tell us about the Hollywood War, just because, you know, Hollywood.
Well, separate to the story of the gangsters versus the Nazis, there was a serious attempt in the mid-30s of Hitler trying to take over Hollywood. Because Hitler had a theory that if he could take over Hollywood, which was the world's greatest by far propaganda machine, he might be able to conquer America without firing a bullet, because the hearts and minds of Americans were tied in so much with what they saw when they went to the movies every week. Now, it didn't work because Hitler couldn't conceive of what L.A. was. What do you mean it doesn't have a Jewish section? What do you mean it doesn't have a German neighborhood? I said, well, it doesn't really have third generation Los Angelinos either. It's everybody new. But there was old money. The movie scene was only about 20 years old. Everybody who was rich before that were oil millionaires, and they were conservative, and a lot of them were anti-Semites, but they weren't really willing to go to war against Hollywood. Hollywood they thought was disgusting, but so what? So the Nazis weren't really latching on the way they had hoped. They started to recruit homeless men in hopes of building an army that way, because L.A. then as now has a conspicuous homeless problem. And again, it was a fellow by the name of Lewis, a Jewish lawyer. He puts together a team of spies to get inside this movement. They find out that the Nazis are planning to kidnap Jewish stars and movie moguls and publicly execute them. But it's not terribly organized. And the guys who want to be the leader are in strong competition with one another. So what they do, and this is pretty smart, is they just start spreading rumors about these guys. This guy wants to stab this guy in the back. This guy's saying this behind your back. And infighting starts, and the whole thing collapses. And that Hitler doesn't even get a foot in the door of Hollywood. And then a few years later, the Bund shows up, and they're having rallies. And so Judge Perlman calls a guy he knew from the old days, Mickey Cohen.
Yeah.
And his pal, Bugsy Siegel, both formerly of Brooklyn, New York, where I am today. And they go to war. And in L.A., things being more spread out, they tended to attack the Nazis one or two at a time
rather than a giant riot or a big.
And Mickey Cohen, and this was a story I knew even before I knew that it was an organized effort. I knew the story of Mickey Cohen being put in the holding cell with the two anti-Semites, and how when the guard left and came back 5 minutes later, and the two anti-Semites are unconscious, and Mickey Cohen's reading the newspaper and says, "Yeah, they had a fight. They knocked each other out. I don't know what it is." But he bumped their heads together like Superman.
Yeah, yeah. Not that he was a good guy, but he talks about how he saw it as a patriotic duty to beat up anti-Semites.
Just because I'm a hood don't mean I ain't no patriot.
Right.
That's right.
I want to thank Michael Benson for a great visit. The book is extremely entertaining. Where can people go to find out more about you and about the book?
Well, I have a page on Amazon.com. You can friend me on Facebook. I'm the Michael Benson with the white beard. Can't miss me. The book should be available at a bookstore near you, if you still have a bookstore near you, or online, any place where you prefer to buy books.
It's called Gangsters Versus Nazis, How Jewish Mobsters Battled Nazis in Wartime America. It's a great read. Michael, thank you so much.
Rabbi Samuel Cohen, thank you so much.
I hope it wasn't too Jewish for you. Just checking.
Just Jewish enough.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohen. Join us next week. Our guest will be Aaron Henney, Artistic Director of Theater Dybbuk, a remarkable Jewish theatrical and creative troupe that's reviving historical Jewish plays. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. And don't miss Shavuot this Saturday night, June 4th, at Beit Simcha with me, Rabbi Sam Cohen. Join us as we explore what is holiness at our Tikkun Leil Shavuot festival service and semi-all-night study session featuring a fabulous cheesecake bake-off, lots of delicious treats and drinks, great Jewish learning. This Saturday night, June 4th, 7:30 p.m. at Beit Simcha, free for everybody. Our playout this morning for the upcoming Festival of Shavuot this Saturday night and Sunday morning with services, Stay Up All Night by the rather silly group Rebbetzin Tap. My friends, have a Chag Shavuot Sameach, a happy coming holiday of Shavuos, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The 6th of Sivan, it's the day that we receive on.
Anything you want to learn, it's all right.
Put some water.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.